Harry and Craig, Mr. and Mrs. Ramirez, Smitta, of course, and Rachel, who lives close enough to the school to walk. He sees them, but he doesn't get out of his car. Not yet. Because one of the trickier qualities of the mind is its ability to be in two places at once. So Tariq sits there, and at the same time, he heads back to the worst night of his life. Factually, 3 months ago. Emotionally, yesterday, and today, and 3 months ago, and any period of time in between. Blood in his mouth. It is like there is still blood in his mouth. The guys were drunk, there were five of them, and while it wasn't in this town, it was in a town close by. Tariq didn't have his license yet, didn't have a car. The movie was over, and he was waiting for his father to pick him up. His friends were heading out for pizza, but he had to get back. His father was running late, and the street became deserted once the end credits of the sidewalk conversations were over. There was someone in the movie theater booth, but that was it. Tariq couldn't stand still, so he walked a little down the block to look in store windows. When the other guys started shouting, he didn't even know they were shouting at him. Ignoring them only made them pay more attention. By the time he understood what was happening, it was happening too fast. He thought at first it was because he was black, but from all the variations of faggot they were throwing his way, he knew it wasn't only that. And some of them were black, too. He tried to walk past them, head back to the movie theater or even to the pizza place where his friends were, but they didn't like that. They boxed him in, and he felt the panic button being pressed. As they made fun of the color of his pants, as they taunted him some more, he tried to shove himself out, threw his whole body into it, but there were too many of them, and they weren't caught by surprise. They shoved him back in, and he tried to shove out again, and this time one guy hit him, a blow right to the chest, and as Tariq bent over, more guys joined in. Because once one guy starts, it's a game. Tariq fell to the ground, remembered someone telling him to curl up, to protect himself that way. They were laughing now, enjoying it, thrilled by it. He couldn't even yell for help because the only sounds he could make were ones he'd never heard before, a wailing, guttural acknowledgement of the sudden, intense pain as they punched and they kicked, laughing their faggots at him as they broke his ribs. Across the street, someone saw. The woman behind the counter of the Thai restaurant came running out, yelling and waving a broom. The guys laughed at this, laughed at her broom, at her broken English. But then two of the busboys came out behind her, and they heard her yelling, "Police!" Tariq didn't see any of this, didn't even hear it. He was trying to get his vision straight, trying to curl further into himself, trying to spit the blood out of his mouth. As far as he knew, they were there. And then, with one last kick, they were gone. His father pulled up a minute later, found him, took him to the emergency room before the police arrived. As he bled on the pavement, pebbles and gravel grinding into his wounds, we felt ourselves bleeding too. As his ribs broke, we could feel our ribs breaking. And as the thoughts returned to his mind, the memories returned to ours. That dehumanizing loss of safety. It is something all of us feared, and many of us knew firsthand. We are not unfamiliar with what happens next with Tariq. The long healing, the surprising concern from some, including his parents, and the unsurprising lack of concern from others, like some, but not all of the police. The assailants covered their tracks well and were never caught. We know who they are, of course. Two of them are haunted by what they did. Three of them are not. Tariq is haunted too, although mostly he is defiant. "They beat the shit out of me," he told people soon after. "But you know what? I didn't need that shit inside of me. I'm glad it's gone." He will not let it stop him from going into the city, from dancing. But still, the fear remains. The bruises. And there, in the back of his mind, residing just as they did in the back of our minds, are the most insidious questions of all. How did they spot me? How did they know? What did I do wrong? People like to say being gay isn't like skin color, isn't anything physical. They tell us we always have the option of hiding. But if that's true, why do they always find us? Cooper's loathing of everyone else, his parents, the people in his town, the men he chats with, is surpassed only by his loathing of himself. There is nothing that will add depth to despair like the feeling of deserving it. Cooper drives around, not knowing what to do, not knowing where to go. He barely notices that he's running low on gas. Then the warning light pops on, and he's almost grateful for it, because now at least there's a next thing to be done. He wasn't always like this. Nobody is ever always like this. There was a time he was happy, a time that the world engaged him, catching inchworms and naming each one, blowing out candles on a cake his mother had made, with 20 of his fifth grade friends around him. A home run in a pivotal Little League game that made him feel like a champion for weeks. A desire to draw, to paint, shooting baskets at lunchtime with the other guys. But high school confused things. He didn't want to do sports anymore. Friends moved away, if not from town, then from his lunch table. The dullness started to pervade the outside of his life. And the noise started to grow on the inside. He spent more and more time on the computer. This wasn't really a choice. It was simply the one thing that was always there. Now his laptop is dead in the back seat. It doesn't really bother him. In another car, Avery drives to Kindling. The land around him is flat, the horizon long. He tries not to rehearse what he's going to say to Ryan, because he doesn't want it to sound like a performance. All of the dates he's been on before have been half-hearted attempts with a boy in town who's known him way too long. Neither one of them was sure what he wanted, so they tried to put one another into that void. It never held, and Avery just happened to realize it 5 minutes before Jason did. "No harm, no foul," Jason had said. And this phrase in itself pointed to why Avery wasn't interested. He wants to be with someone who knows that a harm is much worse than a foul. A boy with blue hair would have to know this, Avery thinks. Or at least there's a chance he knows this. Avery is about to find out. After a year, Peter and Neil feel they are beyond the discovery phase. But we're sure that they will continually discover this not to be the case. There's always something new to learn about the person you love. Neil is not surprised to get to Peter's house and to find him still in his boxers, sitting on the floor of his rec room, navigating a fantasy world on his game console. "I'm sorry," Peter says. "I've almost gotten the Guild of Wizards to sign my treaty. 20 minutes, I swear." Neil foolishly forgot his own homework, so he goes to Peter's room and fetches Peter's homework to do instead. It would be one thing if Peter's game involved massive amounts of battle and sword fightery. But from what Neil can tell, it's more about making and breaking alliances. In other words, politics. With beards and robes. Not his thing. Balkan Bloodbath 12, the game he brought over yesterday, sits on the ground. Peter knows Neil's not into it, but can't help but play anyway. Because once this treaty is signed, he is going to be able to travel to the water nymphs' world for the first time. He doesn't even notice what Neil's doing until he's through. Treaty accomplished, he finds that Neil is halfway through his English assignment. "I can do that," Peter says. He knows he should like it when Neil does his homework for him, but he doesn't. He knows Neil does it because it's easier for him, and that's precisely why Peter doesn't like it. "You have more important things to do," Neil says. "I mean, what's John Steinbeck compared to the fate of the Guild of Wizards?" "I like Steinbeck." "You know what would be cool?" "What?" "If your game took place underwater." Peter knows Neil is going somewhere with this. Some joke. But he can't figure out the punchline. He gives in and asks why. Because then the wizards could be fish, and it would be the Guild of Guild Wizards. Peter smirks. I walked right into that one, didn't I? More like you swam into it. Peter likes these jokes, these jibes. Really, he does. It's just that he's not always in the mood for them. Sometimes he wishes he were dating someone a little stupider, or at least someone who doesn't think about each word in every sentence he utters. Neil doesn't realize he's gone one step too smart. He doesn't change the subject because he senses something slightly wrong. Instead, his innate gauging of the rhythm of the conversation knows it's time to move on. Pancakes, he says. I think we need pancakes. This time Peter knows what's coming and joins in. They both start jumping up and down on one leg, yelling, IHOP! IHOP! We are such wonderful idiots, Peter thinks. We often believe the truest measure of a relationship is the ability to lay ourselves bare. But there's something to be said for parading your plumage as well, finding truth as much in the silly as the severe. Your humor is your compass and your shield. You can hone it into a weapon, or you can pull its strands out to make your very own cotton candy blanket. You can't exist on a diet of humor alone, but you can't exist on a diet without it, either. All the quips in the world couldn't prevent Oscar Wilde from becoming a lovesick fool. But he rallied at the end. More than one of us borrowed his last words, staring off into the distance and uttering, "Either that wallpaper goes, or I do." There were even variations. "Either the mayor goes, or I do." Or, "Mother, either those shoes go, or I do." Or, "Honey, either that mustache goes, or I do." Maybe not our exact last words, and maybe not Oscar Wilde's exact last words either. But you get the point. When the end comes, there will be important things to say, for sure. But there will also be that last laugh, and you will want it. Laughter rarely lasts longer than a few seconds, it's true. But how enjoyable those few seconds are. Before Harry and Craig begin their kiss, they are presented with some gag gifts. Harry's parents present the two boys with a canister of Banaca. We laugh when it's clear that neither boy knows what it is. How would we explain it to them? That long ago, when you wanted your breath to be doused with mint, you'd pull out one of these slim metal tubes and spritz a little Banaca into your mouth. Whether you were covering up booze or covering up a more general sourness, you could rely on this hissing blast to do the trick. It didn't taste like anything natural, and if you were doing it before kissing someone, it always worked best if you both took a dose, so you could taste chemical together. In our arsenal of subterfuge, it was a largely harmless selection. We're amused by its presence now, in the same way that Mr. and Mrs. Ramirez are amused. After an explanation, Harry and Craig thank them, but neither of them tries the spray. They're chewing gum instead. Their friend Rachel shows them that she's decorated a bedpan with the face of an infamous radio talk show host. They won't be able to use it during the kiss, but maybe right afterward. Smitta takes out a bag of Valentine hearts, not easy to find in the off-season, and shows them she's filled the whole bag with hearts that say, "Kiss me," on them. Another friend, Michael, has gone with another holiday and has attached a piece of mistletoe, also hard to find in the off-season, to the end of a fishing line so he can dangle it over their heads as they kiss. Finally, it's Tariq's turn. He's been setting up the cameras, making sure everything's been positioned right, so the lamps that illuminate the yard will also light Harry and Craig once night falls. If the kiss works, nobody's going to take their word for it. Everything needs to be documented precisely, so Tariq's got an army of cameras at the ready and a troop of reinforcement batteries on hand. Not only will the kiss be recorded, it will be streamed live, so no accusation can be made that the kiss was faked, or that any break was edited away. Three of the teachers from school have offered to take shifts as witnesses. Ms. Luna, the head of the math department, is starting. But first, Tariq has his gifts. The first requires him to drag a duffel bag over the grass. "Is that a body?" Harry asks. "Or maybe just a head?" Craig wonders. They are not far off. With a grin, Tariq lifts out a bust of Walt Whitman to preside over the event. Then, to mark the occasion, Tariq recites one of Whitman's poems. "We two boys together clinging, one the other never leaving, up and down the roads going, north and south excursions making, power enjoying, elbows stretching, fingers clutching, armed and fearless, eating, drinking, sleeping, loving, no law less than ourselves owning, sailing, soldiering, thieving, threatening, misers, menials, priests alarming, air breathing, water drinking, on the turf or the sea beach dancing, cities wrenching, ease scorning, statutes mocking, feebleness chasing, fulfilling our foray." Everyone applauds. Then Tariq breaks out his second gift, an iPod with exactly 32 hours, 12 minutes, and 10 seconds of music on it, each song chosen and sequenced with the same care a DJ would use. All of Harry's and Craig's favorite songs are on there, as well as hundreds of other songs donated by friends. "Just tell me when to hit play," Tariq says. They are almost at the start. In another town in the same state, Cooper realizes that a full tank of gas is only going to solve one of his problems, and a minor one at that. He pulls into the parking lot of a Walmart. He takes out his phone and looks at the names in his contacts list. That's what they feel like to him. Contacts. People he has contact with. Contact in class, contact in the hallways or at lunch. Not friends. Not really. Not if being someone's friend means not being fake. He's been fake with all of them. Are there some who'd let him come over if he asked? Sure. Are there even some who would listen to what happened, who would worry on his behalf? Probably. But when he tries to play out that scene with any of them, it falls flat. It doesn't help. It only adds bystanders to what's essentially his burden, and his alone. So he closes his contacts. He opens an app. He decides to talk to some strangers instead. There are 10 messages on his phone, too. He ignores them. Avery arrives in Kindling, and his nerves crescendo. He remembers everything about Ryan, but doesn't really know much about him. What if last night was an aberration? What if, in the ordinary daylight of an ordinary day, the feeling of serendipity dissipates? We called this hope-goggling. The fear that nighttime is really a rose-colored world, and that the morning will show that the things you hoped were happening weren't really happening, that your heart got ahead of itself. And let's be honest, a lot of the time this was true. The force of loneliness was strong, and it swayed us. Or the euphoria of the helium hours was strong enough to lift us into the realm of improbability. The next day, the sugar rush had worn off. The next day, there was very little left to say to each other. But sometimes, it was there. The magic we'd created had remained. Maybe it even grew in the daylight. Because if it could be a part of our day, that meant it could be a part of our lives. And if it could be a part of our lives, it was a magic worth many risks and leaps. We went through this so many times, but Avery has never felt like this before. He doesn't know yet that doubt lingers around anticipation like bees hover around flowers. The trick is to not let the doubt intimidate you into walking away. Doubt is an acceptable risk for happiness. We count down the minutes until Avery pulls into Ryan's driveway. We count down the seconds until Ryan opens the door, comes stepping outside. Because we know that the best antidote for doubt is presence. magic naturally fades over distance. But proximity? Well, when it works, proximity amplifies magic. The blue-haired boy smiles as he approaches the pink-haired boy. The pink-haired boy gets out of his car, finds the blue-haired boy waiting for him. They say their hellos. They teeter in an awkward moment. Then they teeter into a welcome hug, a reunion hug, a this-means-something hug. Anticipation is no longer needed, because the moment is now. Harry and Craig have taken their last proper bathroom breaks for the next 32 hours, 12 minutes, and 10 seconds. The cameras are ready to go. Ms. Luna holds a stopwatch. Other friends have gathered. Harry's parents give the two boys two thumbs up. It's time. Harry leans over and whispers into Craig's ear, "I love you." And Craig leans over and whispers into Harry's ear, "I love you too." Nobody hears them but us. Then it's here. Months of preparation, weeks of practice, and years of living have led up to this moment. They kiss. Harry has kissed Craig so many times, but this is different from all of the kisses that have come before. At first, there were the excited dating kisses, the kisses used to punctuate their liking of each other, the kisses that were both proof and engine of their desire. Then the more serious kisses, the "it's getting serious" kisses, followed by the relationship kisses, that variety pack, sometimes intense, sometimes resigned, sometimes playful, sometimes confused. Kisses that led to making out, and kisses that led to saying goodbye. Kisses to mark territory, kisses meant only for private, kisses that lasted hours, and kisses that were gone before they'd arrived. Kisses that said, "I know you." Kisses that pleaded, "Come back to me." Kisses that knew they weren't working. Or at least Harry's kisses knew they weren't working. Craig's kisses still believed. So the kissing had to stop. Harry had to tell Craig. And it was bad, but not as bad as he feared. They had built a friendship strong enough to withstand the disappearance of kisses. It was off balance at first, for sure. Their bodies not knowing what to do, the magnetism toward kissing still there, because even when the mind shuts off the romance, it sometimes takes a while for the body to get the message. But they made it through that, and they never stopped hugging, never abandoned all contact. Then Craig had this idea, and Harry wanted to do it. Enough time had gone by that when they started kissing again, the electricity was gone, replaced by something closer to architecture. They were kissing with a purpose, but the purpose wasn't them. It was the kiss itself. They weren't using the kiss to keep their love alive, but were using their friendship to keep the kiss alive. First for minutes, then for hours. The hardest thing when kissing for hours was staying awake, focusing. To be connected to someone else, but to be retreating entirely into yourself. Because when you kiss someone, you can't really see them. They become a blur. You must use touch as your touchstone, breath as your conversation. After many attempts, they found their rhythm. They made it to 10 hours one Sunday. That was as far as they'd gotten. And now here they were, trying for more than 3 times as long, all to prove a point. And maybe it's all of the hours, and maybe it's the point that's making this kiss much more intense than Harry had thought it would be. Their lips make contact, and Harry feels a charge. It doesn't rise from the past as much as it's created in the present. Even though it isn't what they had planned, he finds himself putting his arm around Craig's waist, finds himself drawing Craig a little closer, kissing him a little more than the rehearsal kisses. The small crowd cheers for them, and Harry can feel Craig's smile underneath their contact. He can feel that smile in Craig's breathing, in his lips, in his body. Harry wants to smile back, but is gripped by something more profound than a smile, something vast and inarticulate that fills his lungs, fills his head. He has No idea what he's gotten into. No idea what this all means. He thought he knew. He thought it out so many times. But what use is abstraction when it comes to a kiss? What use is planning? Harry kisses Craig and feels there is something bigger than the two of them just outside the kiss. He doesn't reach out to it. Not yet. But he knows it's there. And that makes this unlike any other kiss they've ever shared before. Immediately, he knows this. Craig is still thrown by the "I love you" that Harry whispered to him. That is what he's thinking about when the kiss begins. Tariq makes sure all the cameras and the computers are working. He makes sure the live feed is working. Right now, Tariq is the only viewer online. We settle in. We watch. Ryan doesn't invite Avery inside his house, and Avery doesn't ask why. Where are we headed? Avery asks once they're both strapped into their seats. What's the best Kindling has to offer? Ryan is torn. The Kindling Cafe is easily the best Kindling has to offer. But because of that, most of his school will be there on a Saturday, using the Wi-Fi and hanging out. If he takes Avery there, it will become a group event, and he doesn't want it to become a group event, not yet. So there's only one destination that makes any kind of sense. The river, he tells Avery. How do you feel about heading to the river? I feel great about heading to the river, Avery replies. Exactly what Ryan wants to hear. One of the many horrible things about dying the way we died was the way it robbed us of the outdoor world and trapped us in the indoor world. For every one of us who was able to die peacefully on a deck chair, blanket pulled high, as the wind stirred his hair and the sun warmed his face, there were hundreds of us whose last glimpse of the world was white walls and metal machinery, the tease of a window, the inadequate flowers in a vase, elected representatives from the wilds we had lost. Our last breaths were of climate-controlled air. We died under ceilings. Either the wallpaper goes, or I do. It makes us more grateful now for rivers, more grateful for sky. Avery figures they'll just sit by the river and talk. But Ryan has grander plans than that. He calls his aunt and asks if they can park in her yard and borrow her canoe. She says sure. So instead of heading by the river, they head right into it. It's a boat big enough for two, one in front, one in back. The current isn't very strong, and the space between the shores isn't very wide. They head upstream, not talking much, just a running commentary on the houses they pass, the shape of the clouds overhead. Then they get to a murmuring stretch, a shallow inlet. Here, Ryan says, a drifting spot. They put down their paddles, and Ryan turns his body so they're facing one another. Hi, he says. Hi, Avery says back. I would have brought fishing gear, but it's just so, well, mean to the fish. I'm a vegetarian. Me too. A smile. Of course you are. Avery leans over a little, spreads his fingers in the water. It feels good to create a current, however small. The air is light and the water is quiet, the trees bending from the shore to listen to the tiny waves. The boat rocks gently. So what's your story? Ryan asks. Avery looks up at him, hands still in the water. My story? Yeah. Everyone has at least one. For a few uncomfortable seconds, Avery worries that Ryan thinks he's a mutant, thinks he's a joke, and wants him to come clean. But then Avery realizes from Ryan's expression that, no, it isn't about that. Ryan is trying to craft a conversation and wants it to be a meaningful one. Because what's more meaningful than a person's story? I can start if you want me to, Ryan volunteers. Sure, Avery says. You start. Because it's a little safer that way. Avery doesn't know how he can tell a story without telling the story, and he wants to be sure Ryan was really looking for something that big when he asked his question. "Okay," Ryan says. "Here goes." He takes in an endearingly nervous breath, then exhales the start of his story, telling Avery how almost everybody in his family was born here, and how almost everybody in his family has stayed here, his father being the big exception. He left when Ryan was 3, and Ryan and his mom were stuck for about 5 years after that, until she met his stepfather, Don. He's not that bad as stepfathers go, but he's not what Ryan would have chosen either. He's very old-fashioned about what men do and what women do. Ryan's mom is fine with that. She likes him being the boss. But Ryan's not as okay with it. They had 2 kids together, Ryan's half-sisters, Dina and Sharon. "Dina's really sweet," Ryan says, "and Sharon is going to grow up to be a monster. She's only 8, but you can tell. If things don't go her way, the world has to pay for it, you know?" Avery nods, and Ryan continues. "So yeah, that's the background. I grew up here, and I get into fights sometimes with my parents. My Aunt Caitlin saves my life daily." Okay, that's an exaggeration. She saves my life weekly. "She totally called it on me being gay. My mother was too lost in herself to notice, and Don didn't want to see it, so he ignored it. Caitlin waited for me to catch up to her. I had other things to think about at first, with Don and then my sisters, and just fitting into Kindling. Little League, that kind of thing. But eventually I noticed who I was staring at, and it wasn't the girls. I'll be honest, it freaked me out. I tried to like girls instead. I really did." "How'd that work for you?" Avery asks, letting his voice joke a little. Ryan mocks up a sigh. "Well, I went out with Tammy Goodwin for almost a year, in 4th grade. Really serious. I mean, we bought each other stuffed animals on Valentine's Day. That's practically marriage in 4th grade, right? By high school, I knew who I was. And when I told Caitlin, she wasn't shocked at all. She took me out on this river, in this canoe, and we'd talk about things. She's not a whole lot older than me. She's about to turn 30. And she's had about as much luck with guys as I have. She's the one who convinced me I shouldn't try to hide. She said hiding never worked. She told me my dad spent so much time hiding that it was impossible for him to be happy here. He isn't gay. I guess that makes it sound like he's gay. He isn't. But he didn't want to stay here. He never wanted to stay here. He just wasn't strong enough to tell my mom until it was way too late." Ryan goes on to explain he doesn't hear from his father much now, just a phone call every now and then. Ryan visited him once in California, and it was a disaster. Ryan was 12, but his father planned it out like he was 7. "He tried real hard, but in the wrong ways. He thought Disneyland could make everything better, you know? We ran out of things to say pretty quick. I emailed him when I was coming out to everyone, and his reaction was one of the best ones I got. He told me to do what I wanted to do. But part of me felt like it was easy for him to be okay with it because he'd given up on me a while ago. Like, he wasn't as invested as everyone else." Ryan stops now, self-conscious the moment he steps out of the story. "Gosh," he says, "I'm talking a lot." "No," Avery says. "Go on. How did everyone else react?" "Oh, you know, Mom cried. A lot. Don was angry. Not at me, really, but at the manufacturer for giving him a defective stepson. My sisters, though, were fine, and so were most of my friends. I mean, a couple of them flailed a little in their first reactions. Some of the guys were wondering if I was secretly in love with them, which was only right in one case, but that went nowhere. The girls were by and large cool, even the churchy ones. Well, with one exception there, too. The inevitable rumors started, and I decided the only thing to do was confirm them. So I dyed my hair and started putting LGBT buttons on my bag and made noises about starting a GSA. The assholes in school had the typical asshole reactions. but there were a couple of other gay kids, so we banded together. I dated this one guy, Norris, for about 2 seconds, which was as long as it took for us to realize that the only thing we had in common was that we were gay. Our GSA advisor, Mr. Coolidge, is super cool and has gotten a lot of things done, including the dance last night. That was his idea, the gay prom. We contacted every GSA in the area. I mean, is that how you heard about it? A friend linked me to the Facebook invite, Avery says. Our GSA is kind of lame. Well, whatever got you there, I'm glad you made it. I guess that's the latest plot twist in my story, isn't it? Avery thinks it feels like a responsibility to be a part of someone else's story. He knows Ryan is saying it playfully, not heavily. He knows Ryan is saying it to show that he's done with his own storytelling, which means it's time for Avery to start. Avery isn't sure that Ryan is a part of his own story yet, but that could be because he doesn't feel anyone can be a true part of his story until he or she hears it and accepts it. They're drifting on the water. Not much, just a gradual pull. Avery finds his mind drifting to a small part of Ryan's story, a small point of comparison. When he emerges from that brief thought, he sees that Ryan is watching him, waiting to see what he'll say next. "I was just thinking about you and your aunt in this canoe," Avery explains. "How nice that must have been to talk here. For me, it's always a kitchen table war council, us against the world, coming up with a plan." "That sounds stressful." "Yeah, but at least everyone in my house is on the same side. I know how lucky I am about that. And unlucky in other ways."
"Unlucky how?"
Ryan asks. And this is it. This is where Avery must decide how much to tell, how much to let Ryan in. Like everyone else, Avery considers his inner world to be a scary, convoluted, inscrutable place. It is one thing to show someone your best, cleanest version. It's quite another to make him aware of your deeper, jagged self. Here in the daylight, does Ryan already notice? Does he already know? If he does, it doesn't seem like he cares. Or maybe that's just more hoping on Avery's part. Enough, Avery tells himself. Just talk to him. The first sentence of the truth is always the hardest. Each of us had a first sentence, and most of us found the strength to say it out loud to someone who deserved to hear it. What we hoped, and what we found, was that the second sentence of the truth is always easier than the first, and the third sentence is even easier than that. Suddenly you are speaking the truth in paragraphs, in pages. The fear, the nervousness is still there, but it is joined by a new confidence. All along you've used the first sentence as a lock, but now you find that it's the key. "I was born a boy in a girl's body," Avery begins. Then he stops, takes in Ryan's reaction, which is surprise. His eyes widen a little, then narrow as he takes a long look at Avery, figures it out. Avery feels like a body on display. Or maybe Ryan is just waiting for the next sentence. "Go on," he says. His tone is encouraging. "I think it was obvious to everyone from the start, and my parents are very liberal, I guess, practically hippies, so they actually tried to make it seem like I was normal, or at least going through something normal. Now I can see the strain and how much easier it would have been for all of us if I hadn't been born a girl. But they never made me freak out. It was everyone else. Well, not everyone. There were some people who were cool. But there were a lot of people who weren't cool. I was homeschooled a lot. We lived in a lot of towns trying to find the right doctors. Eventually we found them, and I found other members of my tribe, mostly online. But my parents and I go to conferences as well. They put me on hormones early to sort of stop me from going through the wrong kind of puberty. Is this TMI? I'm sure you don't want all the details."
Brian leans toward Avery, the boat rocking back and forth as he does. Avery grips the side, and Ryan puts his hand on top of Avery's. "Tell me whatever you want to tell me," he says. "It's cool." Avery shudders and can feel the shudder travel through the boat, through the water, until the water becomes smooth again, until he feels his nerves become smooth enough to continue talking. It's too much, too soon, but now that he's talking, he can't stop. He's talking about hormones and the surgeries that have happened and the surgeries that are going to happen, and all along pretty much the only thing that's filling his head is the question of whether Ryan is seeing him as a girl or a boy. Now that Ryan knows, is Avery still a boy in his eyes? Ryan is measuring his next words carefully. In fact, he's been weighing them, trying them out in his head, even as Avery's been talking. We don't blame him. We know it is sometimes hard to receive someone's truth. Not as hard as the telling, but still hard if you care about how your response will be taken. Finally, he says, "I like whatever it is that makes you the person you are." It's like something his Aunt Caitlin would have told him, back when he was figuring things out. Then, to show that he doesn't think this is the entirety of Avery's story, he asks, "Do you have any brothers or sisters?" The conversation continues, and we leave them to have it. We watch from a distance as the boat drifts for nearly a mile, without either of them really noticing. You can give words, but you can't take them. And when words are given and received, that is when they are shared. We remember what that was like. Words so real, they were almost tangible. There are conversations you remember, for certain. But more than that, there is the sensation of conversation. You will remember that even when the precise words begin to blur. How you gave, how you received, how close you felt to this other person, how remarkable this closeness was. The sharing of the words becomes as important as the words themselves. The sensation stays with you, attaches you to the world. It was Craig's idea to kiss like this, and a half hour into it, he still doesn't understand what he was thinking. There are many routes to it. One of them runs deep and connects directly to his childhood, to all those hours he spent poring over the Guinness World Records, dreaming that one day he'd be in it. The odder the record, the better. The world's largest cherry pie, or the man who could fit the most nails in his mouth. As a kid, he probably skipped over the kissing section. Too gross. Then there's the route that runs closest. That runs right to where Tariq is standing with the cameras and the computer monitors, each one tethered to an extension cord they run from the high school. Craig and Harry hadn't really been friends with Tariq, not before he was assaulted. Even though they were all out, they didn't move in the same circles. But when Craig and Harry heard he was in the hospital, heard what had happened, they felt the distance evaporate. Craig pictures him the day they visited his house, his body a badly matched collection of bruises, his usual smile too painful to use. Craig had cried, right there in Tariq's living room, he had cried, and he felt so awful about that. Tariq told him it was okay, everything was okay, they hadn't killed him. Ribs heal, bruises fade. But Craig couldn't stop crying. Not because Tariq was hurt, but because it was so senseless, so enormously wrong. Harry tried to comfort him, and Tariq said more soothing words, and Craig wanted to feel anger. He wanted to feel raw outrage, but instead it was sadness that was filling him, an extreme, helpless sadness. He rallied then, stopped crying, let Tariq tell them what he wanted to tell. But for the next few weeks, the sadness wouldn't let go. At school, he could distract himself from it, and with Harry and Tariq, he could hide it. But when he was home, it engulfed him, because his family didn't know and couldn't know. They wouldn't beat him up. They wouldn't break his ribs. He knew that. But they had other ways of breaking him. With silence, with disappointment, with disapproval. His father would never accept who he was. Never. And his mother would go along with that. They had their beliefs, and those beliefs were stronger than any belief they had in him. Maybe this was the well that his sadness was being drawn from. He knew what it was like to drown in it, to feel the sadness coming up to your neck, your mouth, your eyes. For a long time, he thought he had a demon on his shoulders, weighing him down so he'd drown quicker. The demon liked boys, wanted nothing more than to kiss a boy. Craig couldn't get rid of him, no matter how much he wished it, no matter what promises he made to God. Then he met Harry, and suddenly the demon was revealed to be a friend. He offered Craig a hand, pulled him up. Craig emerged, gasping from the sadness, then created a dam to keep it at bay. He didn't let Harry see it, just like he didn't let his parents see it. It had to remain inside of him. Contained. When Harry broke up with him, the dam came undone. He started drowning again, even as he pretended for Harry and their friends that he could swim. Smitta kept a close eye on him, and in his own way, Harry did too. Their friendship helped him rebuild the dam. He still had his life within his house and his life outside his house, but he was almost used to that. It was all under control. Until he saw Tariq after the assault, and felt in his heart that this was his future, that this time the demons were as bad as he feared, and they were going to win. He hated feeling this way. He hated feeling helpless. He wondered what he could do. How could he stand up for himself? He knew vengeance wasn't an option. He wasn't going to track down the guys who'd beaten up Tariq. He wasn't going to punish them. But there had to be some way to show the world that he was a human being, an equal human being. He thought about protests, about gestures, about making the world watch. Then he thought about world records and came up with the idea of the kiss. There was nothing in the rules that prevented it. To the Book of World Records, a kiss was a kiss, no matter who was kissing. All the record keepers cared about was that the two people were standing the whole time, that there were no breaks, that lips were always touching lips. The only hitch was that Craig couldn't do it alone, and he knew the only person he could do it with was Harry. Harry had no hesitation. He thought it was a great idea. And when Craig and Harry told Tariq about it, it seemed to help him drown a little less, too. Harry was a dreamer, not a planner, so it was up to Craig and Smitta and Tariq to figure out all the logistics. Craig was sure there were things they'd forgotten, and yet here they were. Here he was, kissing Harry. Smitta had been merciless in her teasing. Surely there are less elaborate ways of getting your ex to kiss you again. But it wasn't about that, or at least that's what Craig insisted to himself. It was Harry because they were the same height, no neck strain, because he and his parents were on board, because he took it seriously, because they had trained their bodies and their minds for it in a way that only two people who were really close could do. Harry's lips are so familiar to Craig. He has memorized these lips. And yet each time they were together was a little different. Each time was a small thrill. These lips. Harry's arms around him, their balance together. Craig could lose himself in this, if there weren't the need to keep it going for 31 more hours, if there weren't people watching, if it were about him and Harry, not about him, Harry, and the world. "Don't think of it as kissing him," Smitta said. "Think of it as standing for 32 hours with your lips together." But how can he not think of it as kissing? He remembers the first time Harry kissed him, leaning over in the movie theater as the credits rolled. The surprise of it. The welcome surprise. The whole world narrowing down to that one intersection of skin and breath. Then expanding out, larger than before. A gasp of a kiss. His body remembers that. even now, even still. They have their signals, for water, for phone, for needing a squeeze, for calling the whole thing off. But there's no signal for what Craig is feeling. There is no way his hand can take the form of a question mark. He looks into Harry's eyes, wondering what Harry is thinking. Harry sees him, and Craig can feel his smile. But he still doesn't know what that means, or really what any of this means, except for the fact of doing it. There are fewer than 100 people watching them online, mostly Harry and Craig's friends, too lazy or too far to come see it in person. A few of those friends forward the link to other friends. "This you have to see," they say. A few more tune in. Two boys kissing. You know what this means. For us, it was such a secret gesture. Secret because we were afraid. Secret because we were ashamed. Secret because it was a story that nobody was telling. But what power it had. Whether we cloaked it in the guise of "you be the boy and I'll be the girl," or whether we defiantly called it by its name, when we kissed, we knew how powerful it was. Our kisses were seismic. When seen by the wrong person, they could destroy us. When shared with the right person, they had the power of confirmation, the force of destiny. If you put enough closets together, you have enough space for a room. If you put enough rooms together, you have space for a house. If you put enough houses together, you have space for a town, then a city, then a nation, then a world. We knew the private power of our kisses. Then came the first time we were witnesses, the first time we saw it happen out in the open. For some of us, it was before we ourselves had ever been kissed. We fled our towns, came to the city, and there on the streets we saw two boys kissing for the first time. And the power now was the power of possibility. Over time, it wasn't just on the street or in the clubs or at the parties we threw. It was in the newspaper, on television, in movies. Every time we saw two boys kissing like that, the power grew. And now, oh now, there are millions of kisses to be seen, millions of kisses only a click away. We're not talking about sex. We are talking about seeing two boys who love one another kiss one another. That has so much more power than sex. And even as it becomes commonplace, the power is still there. Every time two boys kiss, it opens up the world a little bit more. Your world. The world we left. The world we left you. This is the power of a kiss. It does not have the power to kill you, but it has the power to bring you to life. Nobody is watching as Peter and Neil kiss. It is just a quick kiss as they leave the IHOP before they head home. It is a syrupy kiss, a buttery kiss. It is a kiss with nothing to prove. They don't worry about who might see, who might pass by. They're not thinking about anyone but themselves, and even that feels like an afterthought. It is just a part of who they are together, something that they do. Walking through the aisles of Walmart, Cooper isn't thinking about kissing. He is scrolling through his app, chatting with strangers, and kissing isn't on any of their minds. He came into the store because he was getting sick of the inside of his car, was feeling stupid just sitting there in the parking lot as moms and old people paraded in front of him with their shopping carts. Now he walks around as his mind is fragmented into screens and windows, torsos and come-ons, stats and entreaties. Most of the guys on here are older, some much older, than him. Cooper ignores the much older ones, but that still leaves him plenty to choose from. "Hey, Cooper." Cooper doesn't even recognize his name at first. This guy is telling him all the things he wants to do with his mouth, and all Cooper has to do is type, "yeah," and "wow," and "oh, man," for the guy to go on. Cooper? It's the second time that gets through, and he looks up and sees this girl Sloane from school looking at him weirdly. Shit, he thinks, shoving the phone into his pocket. Sloane laughs. You're pretty intense there. Don't let me interrupt you. Cooper wonders what she saw. It was just a chat screen. No photos. She's not close enough to have read it, right? It's nothing, he mumbles.
Oh, I know all about your secret life, Cooper.
Cooper feels like he's going to drop something, and he's not even holding anything. Sloane is in a few of his classes. Sometimes they're at the same lunch table. He never sees her outside of school. How could she know anything?
You're an undercover Walmart cop, aren't you? Tracking delinquent teens like me? My eyeliner makes me a heavy shoplifting threat. I know the profiling that goes on here.
Cooper doesn't know what to say.
I take your silence as complicity.
Sloane puts up her hands. Check my pockets if you must. Why won't she just go away? Cooper's phone is vibrating like crazy in his pocket, and he imagines she can hear it every time it does. She lets her hands fall. She's gotten the message that Cooper isn't playing along. But really, she says, what are you up to? He really wants her to go away. He keeps his answer as short as possible. Shopping.
For what?
Gas.
Gas?
He feels stupid. Why did he say that?
For the grill?
Because it's supposed to get warm tomorrow?
Sure.
This is the problem with having a barrier between you and everyone else. You see it, but they don't. They talk to you, but you can't talk back to them. They care about things like the weather and what you're shopping for, and you don't care about a single thing. It is so obvious to you, and it is infuriating that they don't understand. It just highlights that you're the one who's defective. You're the one who can't be normal. You're the one who has to suffer while everyone else gets to live out their delusions. We know. We've been there. If Sloane were a friend, she would see something was wrong. If Sloane were a friend, she would feel comfortable asking what was wrong. But Sloane's not a friend. She's just a girl he knows. A contact. His phone is out of control in his pocket. Sloane looks at him funny. Then finally she says, okay, Mr. Social. I'll see you Monday. Good luck with the grill. See you Monday, Cooper says. He even tries to make it sound like he's looking forward to it, because that will get rid of her faster. The barrier still stands. Sloane moves on, and Cooper takes the phone out of his pocket. These guys have barely realized he was gone. Cooper flicks through, still trying to find the guy he actually wants to meet. All of these men and boys with their computers, all of these men and boys with their phones, all after the drug-like rush of doing something adventurous, doing something they consider to be on the edge of something else. All of these men and boys fragmenting themselves, hoping the fragments are pieced together on the other end. All of these men and boys trying out this new form of gratification. All of these men and boys still lonely when the rush is over, and the devices are off, and they are alone with themselves again. There is a term for this. The term is limbo. Better to be drifting in a canoe. Better to be brushing back your hair as it blows into your eyes. Better to know that everything you say is meant. Better to know that everything you say is heard. Ryan asks Avery about the pink hair. I know, strange color choice, right? For a boy born as a girl who wants to be seen as a boy. But think about it. It just shows how arbitrary gender is. Pink is female, but why? Are girls any more pink than boys? Are boys any more blue than girls? It's something that's been sold to us, mostly so other things can be sold to us. My hair can be pink because I'm a boy. Yours can be blue because you're a girl. If you free yourself from all the stupid arbitrary shit that society controls us with, you feel more free, and if you feel more free, you can be happier. My hair's blue because I like blue, Ryan says. And mine is pink because I like pink. And I totally didn't mean to lecture you. It just makes me mad. all the stupid arbitrary shit. It makes you want to overthrow the world. On a daily basis. Stupid, arbitrary shit. We know what Avery means, and we also know